Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast. I'm Barry Schwartz. I'm here with Ernest Wong, Head of Research at Baskin. Second week of January. Thank you for joining us. It's 2026. Time is flying. You know, there's no breaks in the market. There's no off-season, right? Unlike a baseball player or a hockey player where you can take time off to work on your golf game, you really can in markets.
Well, apparently the NASDAQ is testing 24-hour trading.
Oh, great. So what does that mean? What is that going to mean for all of us?
No, I think practically speaking, there's some things to work out in terms of how that actually works in practice, such as how you disseminate material information, those kinds of things.
I guess for those who like checking their stock prices and their portfolio values in real time every second of the day, they now will have the ability to do that 24/7. So lots of fun. We're going to talk about some noteworthy and newsworthy items that have come up at the beginning of the year. We'll get into that. But before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, of course, please subscribe to us on YouTube, on Spotify, and Apple. We'd love your 5-star reviews. We love your feedback. Check out our website, of course, if you're interested in our wealth management services and solutions. We'd love to chat with you about your portfolio. So, Ernest, you've compiled a few things that have hit the headlines, and we own a number of the stocks that have been impacted by, you know, it's rare that you get great news headlines, right? It's always bad news headlines.
Yes.
But, you know, that's what the market does. It climbs a wall of worry. We're pleased to say the last week's podcast where we talked about the impact of Venezuela on some Canadian oil and gas companies, I mean, that storm has passed now. One of the companies that we own, Canadian Natural Resources, beaten up as the worries that all of a sudden there'll be a ton more of oil on the markets. And turns out the market thought about it and says, there's no chance that's happening. In the meantime, oil prices have climbed. So I think Canadian Natural Resources is now up again for the year.
Yeah, it does seem to be a market both for energy and for other sectors as well, such as software, where the headlines and the narratives are certainly dominating the stock price reactions we're seeing.
So you're going to get a lot of confirmation bias, of course, when you start reading headlines or reacting to stock price narratives, right? You're going to see everybody talking about it. And of course, if you are on social media and you pay attention to those kind of things, you're just going to get fed more of the same takes.
Yeah, I think one example that that was really early in my investing journey was Apple in 2015, when shares were trading at under 10 times earnings. Yeah. Steve Jobs was dead. The iPhone had kind of stagnated in terms of sales. And the narrative for Apple was that this was a company that was selling a commodity device. They have no pricing power. They were losing market share in China because of apps like WeChat. And there was no innovation or any new products in the pipeline.
You don't have to tell me about it. I lived through it. We were shareholders. Yeah. We started buying Apple in 2012, had a nice run up to about 2015, then got absolutely nailed on the stock. And everybody was saying, well, the story's over. This is BlackBerry, yep. Nokia again. There's no moat here. It's just a hardware company. The Chinese are going to invent better phones, as you said. And the stock was hurt. And I remember people saying there's no catalyst, it's dead money.
Yep.
The same thing everybody says when a stock goes against you until it starts working for you.
And I think the lesson there is not so much that you necessarily shouldn't pay attention to what people are saying about a company, but to really trust your own analysis and to understand that companies change. They are probably working on things that you're not even aware of.
Yeah.
And most likely, if you are selling because of something that you read on social media, you're probably reacting to the same worries that everybody else has.
The funny thing at the time is the fundamentals for Apple were very, very good. And of course, when people get nervous, their opportunities present, especially to patient investors, a la Warren Buffett, of course, who I think famously started his massive Apple investment at that time.
Yep.
Right. And so, listen, if you want to feel good every moment about everything that you own, don't go into investing. Don't buy stocks, because that's not going to happen. And especially in a diversified portfolio, you're going to have things that are just not going to work. So focus on the forest, not necessarily the trees. As long as the trees are being fed well, they'll take care of themselves. So the first thing that we saw as we started January was worries about, but changes in the Federal Reserve. Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, being subpoenaed.
So yeah. So before, I think that people who listen to the podcast are going to notice that we are omitting a certain person's name.
Yes.
And apparently we were told by our podcast editor that if we say this specific name, the reach of the podcast becomes throttled.
Yes.
So he who must not be named is kind of like Harry Potter.
Where for you sure, can't for name sure. It, yeah.
But basically, the U.S. president opened an investigation into Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for, you know, basically lying about the renovations of one of the buildings. Mm-hmm. And this is you kind of universally recognized and admitted by Jerome Powell in a video that it was an attempt to influence interest rate policy. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I think understandably so. There's concerns that, you know, is the Fed independent? What does this mean for the U.S. economy if there's no Fed independence and all these kinds of things, right? So that was certainly something that dominated the headlines.
Certainly nothing new for anybody paying attention to history, of course, or reading history about how U.S. presidents have interacted with other Federal Reserve chair people and the influence that they've tried to exert over the Federal Reserve. Of course, every administration wants lower interest rates. Why wouldn't they? I want more money. I'm going to try and do everything in my power to get more money, to get my economy going, and lower interest rates do provide good stimulus. And so whenever interest rates go up and maybe under someone else's administration, the next administration is going to say, get it down, make us look good. And so, you know, don't hate the player so much, maybe hate the game a little bit.
Right. And I think that's certainly true if you kind of go through the history of the Federal Reserve, where, you know, the current pressures on the Fed are certainly not the first attempt and probably won't be the last attempt.
And that's why it's important. It has to stay and remain independent and focus on its two goals, the economy and interest rates and unemployment, right?
Right. Right. And so I think the worries about how this is unprecedented are probably a little bit hyperbolic.
Yes.
In the sense that I think if you go even going back to Nixon or President Johnson and going back all the way, there were very blatant attempts by these presidents to influence interest rate policy. Mm-hmm. President Reagan, for example, I was just reading about this. He actually proposed that they place the Federal Reserve under the Treasury Secretary, mm-hmm. because he thought that, you know, again, he wanted interest rates to be lower because it helps his reelection bid and is providing a tangible form of benefit of the economic management to the people.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know whether the administration is going about it the right way.
Yep.
Clearly it's going about it in its own particular way. And that lends to uncertainty. The markets initially reacted, but I think one of the things that markets are focusing on is there's going to be a new Fed chairperson appointed this year anyways. Mm-hmm. So the current Federal Reserve, its strength and powers are going to be, it's going to change.
Right.
And we'll see what happens. I mean, is anything truly independent in this world anymore?
Well, I think certainly that interest rate policy certainly does matter for a large segment of the mm-hmm. economy. Mm-hmm. So look at home builders, for example, right? Lower interest rates are going to help home builders because people are going to be able to afford mortgages more easily. Mm-hmm. And so I think these type of macro considerations matter even for individual companies, but harder to predict how they actually play out.
Tying it to our portfolio, of course, we have companies in our portfolio that if interest rates go up and it does lead to a stimulus in home building and home renovation and businesses spending money and consumers spending money, it will be positive, right? So we're not necessarily against interest rates being lowered as long as it makes sense in the context of inflation in the economy, right? And so if you look at the inflation numbers that have come out in the past few months, still higher than what I think the Federal Reserve is targeting, but certainly a gigantic improvement from the crazy numbers of 21 and 2022.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I think that, you know, like, I think this is one of those things where you really don't know how it plays out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's still ongoing uncertainty about tariffs, right? Which are clearly an inflationary force in the economy. Mm-hmm. We have, on the flip side, you have, you know, weaker kind of anecdotes about weaker employment, companies like Meta laying off 1,000 workers seemingly every month, and what that does to consumer spending and those kinds of things. So very hard to know how it ultimately plays out.
Yeah. I mean, bottom line, as chief investment officer, head of research, how are we building our portfolio? We're certainly not building it to take advantage of higher interest rates in the future. We're hopeful that interest rates stay where they are or come down a bit. And I think the way we've designed our fixed income portfolio and some of the investments that we own in our portfolio will certainly do well or should have an improvement as a result of lower interest rates if that follows through. And of course, predicting interest rates is like impossible. Anything can happen with the economies and inflation. Things can change really quickly.
No, so I think from a practical perspective, the way that I look at these kinds of things when looking for stocks is that I think we're looking for companies that are going to, you know, they would benefit certainly from a lower interest rate environment because demand would pick up for the types of services that they offer, but also having a strong balance sheet and the financial stability, so to speak, in case interest rates rise.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of names in our portfolio that have large cash balances so that when interest rates rose, like they were actually making more money and benefiting from interest rate increases versus a more levered competitor.
Yeah. So, and that has to do with either owning a quality company or having a quality management team that understands smart capital allocation and understands the returns that they can earn from just safety and,
right.
And cash. We all know here in Canada, of course, interest rates have come down materially fixed income returns are lower in Canada versus the U.S. Canada's already done the heavy lifting of cutting interest rates. We'll see if the U.S. follows suit. That was last year. This is this year. Things change, of course, with the economies. But I don't think it's never been our approach to bet on in any one direction where interest rates are going to go.
No, I don't think it matters for most of our names because if you look at Constellation Software, like we've talked about this before, where they're making investments at like 20-30% return on investments. So just because the interest rate for government bonds goes from 5-4%, it has no impact at all on how Constellation is going to be deploying its capital because the returns are so high. And I think that those are the situations that are ideal where you're not going to be influenced that much by these short-term macro considerations.
So let's move on to another noteworthy item that came out, of course, and that is potential of U.S. administration capping interest rates on credit cards for 1 year.
At 10%.
I mean, as a human being, of course, obviously you don't want people paying interest rates of 28% on their outstanding balances of credit cards. I mean, those interest rates are insane. But dramatically lowering it to 10% can cause a ripple effect in that could be very, very onerous and punishing to the whole U.S. financial system. So it may be something where someone said, hey, that sounds like a good idea, but in practicality, I don't think it will work.
No, so I think there's a kind of a societal perspective on this proposal, as well as a, you know, ecosystem and how it ends up impacting the various players in the industry type of analysis. I think that, first of all, this is just a tweet. There's no actual even legislation in place to push through this proposal. But it is building on a proposal by Senator Josh Hawley and Bernie Sanders to cap interest rates at 10%. So this is not an entirely novel idea by the U.S. president. And I think from a societal perspective, I think that it's been pointed out by a lot of people that there's plenty of unintended consequences of such a proposal, because if you think about the way that credit cards and how people use them today, there's two types of people, right? There's low-income borrowers who use credit cards and are paying 28% interest. But there's also a wealthy segment of people who kind of just use credit cards as a way for to get some rewards on the spending.
Yeah, that plus it's convenient. So, you know, don't always walk around with cash anymore. Yep. A lot of places since the pandemic don't take cash. You get points, you get rewards, you get the comfort that if you there's fraud, you can get your money back. I mean, there's a lot of benefits to credit cards, but you raised the point. Is what if you lower the cap on interest rates to 10%, it can cause what it's a moral hazard where people may do crazy things who can't afford, and then when the year is up, go back to that 28% and be really screwed.
No, so the reason why credit cards charge these high interest rates is, I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one is that these are unsecured short-term loans where the borrower has no recourse against any of the personal assets of the borrower.
Okay.
So they can't get your house, they can't, you know, go and take money out of your bank account.
Yeah. Good point.
Number two is that these are it's very hard to securitize credit card loans because they are all very correlated. So you're not diversifying your risk by securitizing them in the way that you would do for mortgage-backed securities.
Okay.
And then third of all is that they pay a lot of rewards, right? So some of the interest is just really paying for these rewards, that like the 4% cash back that you save from credit cards. And so I think the if you cap credit card interest at 10%, what you would see is that most likely the banks, who are the ones that are, and to be clear, it's the banks that are setting the interest rate on credit cards, not Visa and MasterCard and American Express. Or not American
Express. American Express does make money.
But it's the
Visa
banks that set the interest rate. What would happen is that the banks would no longer issue credit to people who are low credits because they're not going to be able to recover. You know, they're going to be losing money on issuing credit to these people at 10%. And the unintended consequence is that these people are going to be forced to go to the payday loan market, where they are probably paying annualized interest of 200, 300%. So it's actually clearly a very negative proposal that would limit credit to people who actually need it the most, right?
I think if you want to achieve the goal of informing the public that you're paying too much on your credit cards, give them the knowledge, let them learn about it, run programs, let them understand that credit cards shouldn't be used to just never pay off your balance because you're going to get screwed, right? And so there are better ways to achieve whatever end you want to achieve. And so clearly, how does this affect our portfolio? Of course, we own, our clients own Visa. We own no U.S. banks. We own two Canadian banks, but they have very limited exposure in the United States. So we did see that Visa stock went down, but Visa shouldn't really be too much impacted by this.
Right.
Because it doesn't make money on the interest on the credit card loans anyways.
Yeah, I think first of all, it's very hard to see how such a proposal would even ultimately get implemented because the president does not have the authority to cap interest rates without the approval of Congress. And I think a lot of the Republicans have already kind of spoken out against this proposal and the impact that it would have on people. I think that there has been some chatter about kind of a slimmed down version of this where Congress would look at passing the Credit Card Competition Act in 2023. But even that one is pretty unlikely to pass. Mm-hmm. And because it requires some pretty substantial changes to the plumbing of how the credit card industry would work, with a lot of kind of things that the industry would have to work out.
Okay. So
I think from Visa's perspective, I think the stock is down 8% in the last week because of the worries about this proposal. But it's almost like the Canadian natural stock price reaction, where it's all driven based on the headline, not really kind of thinking through how these things all play out.
That's right.
And that's kind of the market that we're in today.
That's indicative of our style. So that's all we have for you this week. I think next week we'll talk about, we've had some questions about, does it still make sense to own U.S. securities with all these, you know, tweets and headlines that come out? Does it cause you to say, hey, maybe I should look at other countries who may or may not be throwing, you know, stuff at the wall and seeing if it's going to stick or not? And so we're definitely get into that. And earnings seasons is starting to pick up, so we'll make sure to start covering some of our companies. So with that, we'll see you back here real soon. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.